members, I will now call the Post-Secondary Education and Lifelong Learning Subcommittee to order. Kirsten, please call the roll.
Chair Mariano.
Here.
Vice Chair Mello.
Here.
Ranking Member Alexander.
Here.
Representative Andrade is excused. Representative Arrington.
Here.
Representative Bell.
Here.
Representative Botana.
Here.
Representative Caruso.
Here.
Representative Fernandez-Barquin.
Here.
Representative Gottlieb.
Here.
Representative Harding.
Here.
Representative Mooney.
Here.
Representative Morales.
Present.
Representative Persons Malika.
Here.
Representative Placencia is excused. Representative Salzman.
Here.
Representative Tan is excused. Representative Williams.
Here.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you. So everyone, welcome back. We're all happy to be back, maybe a little too soon, but hopefully we'll get to work on some fun things this session. So we'll try to keep it interesting for you, starting with a great presentation today. First, I want to just recognize a couple new members that we have on the committee, Representative Harding and Representative Williams. Well, there you are. And we also have our new Vice Chair, Representative Mello. She's already on the committee, but she got a promotion, so congratulations. And, of course, our new Ranking Member, Representative Alexander. Happy to have you. All right, so today we're going to have Chancellor Kreischer with the Board of Governors, who will provide us an update on the implementation of portions of three recently enacted bills that many of you worked on this previous session. Those bills are the following. House Bill 233 by Representative Roach, which contained a requirement that the Board of Governors and the State Board of Education select or create an intellectual freedom and viewpoint diversity assessment for use at our state universities and state colleges. The next is House Bill 1507 by Representative Yarbrough and Representative Mello, which was our workforce bill. And lastly, House Bill 1261 by Representative Toledo, which contained three new tuition and fee waivers. Working with Representative Toledo on these waivers were Representative David Smith and me. Chancellor Kreischer, you are recognized to come on up. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Chair Mariano. I take this off at my own risk because my wife and daughters tell me I look a lot better with it on. But I might be a little bit mumbled if I don't. Members, it's my pleasure to be with you this morning. I'd like to spend a little bit of time walking through the discussion. I've become suddenly very nervous because I've heard that this was going to be a great presentation, so the bar has been set. I hope I fulfill that before I leave. I did want to take 1 second before I start. And just do a little bit of a quick update and a little bit of a bragging. Many of you probably heard from your area universities or your state universities about some of their national rankings last year. But I am excited to be able to talk about the fact that Florida still continues to be ranked by U.S. News and World Report as the number one state for post-secondary education. It is something that we ascribe to because of the investment that you have made. And I think I'm sounding quiet. Am I okay? Am I better here? All right. It is something that I think, frankly, we attribute, one, to the investment that this legislature and our governor have made in the university system and our ability to focus and serve the 400 and now over 430,000 students that we have attending public universities in the state of Florida. We're now awarding over 97,000 degrees in our state with much more focus in current time on the degrees that are actually sought by Florida employers. And so we believe that by recruiting the right students, by working closely with them to help them focus on graduation, and not only graduation, but what their careers are in front of them as they graduate, we've been able to achieve a lot. We've also been able at the same time to maintain the second lowest tuition in the country. And to all that, I believe we're now being recognized nationally for the quality of our education, as well as making education affordable in Florida. To the subject today, what I wanted to do is walk hopefully briefly through each of the bills that we were asked to report on and give you a heads up or an update on where we've made progress. And I'd say we've done it across all of them. In House Bill 233, the Intellectual Freedom and Viewpoint Diversity Study, we are working with the Political Institute at Florida State University And as background, if you're not familiar with it, the Institute was actually created by the legislature in 2020. We saw it as a potential resource for us to work in the development of the survey mechanism, and we're currently in the process now of designing the survey that will come out. Our plan then is to work through the implementation of that, which is essentially how do we deliver it to our students, to our faculty, to our employees, and how do we get back the results so that they can be evaluated. And I expect that when we're done, we will be able to report back to you by the deadline, no later than the deadline, with the results that we've had from the survey. As a personal point, one of the things that was important to me was to look at this, and I thought of it in the way I would have in my past background, is if a business wanted to know more about their customers and they wanted to know more about their employees, then you'd want to ask questions that ultimately would allow you to evaluate and understand where you had opportunities to improve, where you might compare to your competitors. And so we're hoping by doing this as a system-wide approach, and we are in conversations, I don't want to bind them to this, but we're also in conversations with the Florida College System about how it might be possible to use a similar mechanism across all of our post-secondary students and our faculties so that we can best understand what the climate is in Florida. And I believe that we will be able to report back to you with meaningful results by the deadline. Fingers are faster than my clicker. With regard to House Bill 1507, the nursing education programs, we are in the process of developing the survey mechanism and the questions that needed to be asked and answered in a fairly general format. What I would share with you is there's certain amounts of, as we respond to the questions that were put to us in the statute, certain things we can do directly by surveying our institutions. There are elements of this which would involve the life or career success of our nursing graduates that we're going to need to develop or in the process of developing a survey mechanism. Our hope is that we will also be able to work directly with the professionals in this area in order to collect the information. So we're working with the Department of Education, we're working with the Department of Health, and working to develop the best possible way to gather that information. I don't know that we have any challenges in this other than I think that what we're going to rely on in that case is we're actually going to at some point be actually surveying graduates from our universities or our colleges and then understanding as they proceed or advance in their careers, be able to track their progress and bring that back. So some of this will be statistical and from databases we already have. Another piece of this will be actually talking to our nursing graduates. And before I start the presentation, I also wanted to share and maybe explain to you, we did something different this year that I think I'm kind of happy with right now. We have worked with Florida Trend Magazine, and as I talk about each of these waivers that are coming up, one of the projects we had this year was to partner with Florida Trend Magazine in their next edition of Florida Trend. This is a document that actually goes out to our high school juniors and seniors. It is a career development, and that's not focused solely on universities or even on colleges and universities. It's looking and working with students and thinking about what they're going to do after high school. It starts in the magazine at about page 14, but I just want to share with you that in this material we have also delineated the three waivers that this legislature asked to be implemented. So we are starting early in this process to make sure that students are aware of the opportunities that are in front of them. This not only goes to high school juniors and seniors and their families, but it's also a tool that can be used by counselors and others who may be guiding students and making them aware of what some of the specific opportunities are in Florida. And we're hopeful that now, I guess I wanted you to understand that we approach this not just from a compliance perspective. We're actually pretty excited about it. We're bragging about it, and we hope to continue to do that because it's going to be our students' awareness that really makes the difference. In the area of the program, would enable students in particular degrees where we have gaps between our degree production and our workforce demand, and I'll talk about that a little bit in more detail. Essentially, it recognizes that when a student's completed 60 hours and they're enrolled in particular degrees, if they buy one class, they get the next class in that area of discipline for free. And so it is intended to incentivize, hopefully, students who might otherwise have not chosen to go into these particular STEM areas to consider them and to think about the savings that they may realize as a result of it. And the design of this led us to focusing on 8 programs, and I have a chart behind this that'll help explain some of that. But effectively, what we were asked to do is identify degree areas in STEM that were offered by a majority of our universities, which would be 7 out of the 12. And what we did is then looked at our enrollment, and we looked at the gaps that we have between degree production and workforce demand, employer demand, that we have as a part of our annual review that we do in our programs of strategic emphasis. And so these are the 8 degrees that qualify under those criteria. We're working closely with all of our universities in terms of the implementation, and we're going to be tracking this and reporting back to you all in terms of the waivers that are appropriate. And then quickly, I had a nice wordy chart, and then I had to put a data chart up, but I just wanted you to see, when we applied that test, basically we were able to identify 11 degrees across the system. It would be the first 8 of these are the ones that are actually eligible for the Select STEM waiver program. And our estimate right now is that the fiscal impact of this would be about $12 million a semester. And our hope and plan is to be able to implement this fall, spring, and summer as well, because one of the discussions we've had over the summer was that what we don't want is our STEM students to be disincented from enrolling in summer if that's when they would normally do it. We don't want people waiting. We want them to be able to stay on course for graduating, and we wanted to make sure we didn't have a disincentive for students that would kind of similar to what the legislature did in the past when we extended Bright Futures to summers. We didn't want to create a disincentive economically for students to go into these programs. The grandparent waiver. And the next two waivers, I would add one other discussion point that kind of an overview to this as to what we're doing. One of the decisions we made early on was that from a system perspective, in this case, we had 350 waivers per year. What we have started with is an initial allocation to each of the 12 universities so that they can receive applicants. But we're working to try to capture if someone, this wasn't like a use them up if you can. What we're trying to do is fulfill the waiver cap by working with the universities, giving each university an initial allocation so that they, and when they fill that, if they need more, if they get more applications, we're trying to send more waivers out to them. And by the same token, if a university for some reason is undersubscribed, we want to gather those opportunities together and then be able to offer it where there may be more demand. It begins in fall of 2022. It is targeted out-of-state undergraduate students with grandparents who reside in Florida. They are required to meet test score eligibility, and this is intended for individuals who have graduated high school and are going immediately into post-secondary education. And the implementation status, as I've said, our board has revised its regulation. We did that at our June board meeting. We're working with the universities at this point in terms of the application, and we expect to have the waivers applied and then be able to report back to you by fall of 2022. And then the free seat is intended to incentivize individuals, one who have had military service, military activity, but also recognizing these are referred to as non-traditional students, and by that I want to clarify what it means is an individual who left high school, did their service, for whatever reason has not probably because they were doing their service, has not had an opportunity to go directly into post-secondary education, but to create an incentive where they may come back, where they would decide that this was an opportunity to try to advance their academic credentials and build on that. Again, in this case, we have a statutory cap of 1,000 per year, and we're going to apply it in a similar way that we start with an initial allocation to each of the universities. We're going to do everything we can then to track, to recollect those that aren't subscribed fully, and offer those to the universities who may have opportunities and requests for applicants. In June, we revised our regulation to cover the implementation of the waiver. We're working closely with the 12 universities. In this case, we took 70% of the 1,000, simply because that's an easy number for even me to calculate. And then what we're doing is working with the universities to coordinate and communicate and make sure that we get as high an usage of this opportunity as we possibly can in the state. Madam Chair, that's my prepared presentation, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions? Representative Alexander, ranking member, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chancellor, thank you so much and for your leadership and service to the state and the great success of our state universities. The numbers are fantastic in regards to the upward mobility of the numbers. Do I have latitude to maybe ask some general questions that may not be pertaining to the actual presentation, but they are applicable to the BOG?
Let's try to keep it to the subject of the presentation, but if something, you know, veers off, that's in the context of the presentation, that's okay.
Okay, I'll attempt to do that. So in regards to, I do have a question of clarification that may be helpful for me, Chancellor, and I know some institutions from an enrollment management standpoint have been asking questions in regards to this. Is there a set board policy for the percentage of incoming freshman classes in regards to profile admit students, or is that based off each individual BOT's discretion?
Representative, I don't know that I understand the question when you said a state policy for the profile.
Yeah. So does the Board of Governors have a set policy for all of the state universities in regards to profile admit students, and there being a specific percentage of students from the freshman class enrolling? So from my
on profile admit students.
Yes, sir.
Right. And Madam Chair.
You're right.
And so I would for others who don't know that term. There is a minimum standard, I believe in statute, for admission to state universities in terms of an entering grade point average and an entering test score. The system, the university, each individual university is actually able to admit students who don't meet that standard based on some other information or data that you have about the individual where you believe they would be successful at a university. It could be anything, frankly, from an athlete to someone who has particular talent in music or some other area. It's really up to the universities to make those decisions.
Okay.
I think there's been a sensitivity, at least, to understanding when those numbers exceed 10%, of your admissions as to where the true need is. And frankly, I think the other side that we try to balance that with is what the success is of those students. When I say that, I mean that two of the things that we put a lot of focus on, one is on retention, whether or not a student who enrolls in fall re-enrolls the following fall. It's not a terribly high standard, I hate to say it that way, but it isn't. It's you have to have a 2.0, your second fall, in your college work in order to be considered as having retained. So one of the things we're sensitive to is making sure that we're not enrolling students who we're not prepared to make successful. And I think we have an accountability to our students to have the advising and counseling that matches that. I honestly have not looked at a scan recently to know the exact numbers individual institutions. But those are the general, that's the general framework through it. I think the more active conversation really is at the focus of, do those students, are they retained? Are they successful? Do they graduate? And those two things work together.
And I'm almost done. Yeah.
You're right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think you said that extremely well, Chancellor, and I agree with you. And what I'm going to do, because I don't want to hijack the meeting, I will make a general statement, and then maybe this is something we can have a further conversation in the future. And there are two points I want to make. But you make a very profound point in regards to the resources being in place to support those students, and I appreciate you saying that, because that's essential. Because what happens is these institutions, they make strides, and then what got them there, those potential resources disappear. And so that's on the legislature, not on you, to make sure those resources are there. So what you're saying is that there's no set policy in regards to it. However, there's a general theme of that 10%, and the individual Board of Trustees have the decision-making authority to make that determination. Is that what you're saying?
And the Board of Governors would have that discussion as well. I'm sorry, I didn't. And the Board of Governors would be watching that as well as looking, because I think you've got to balance, if we're enrolling students mm-hmm. who aren't successful, we're not creating to their lifetime success. We're actually distracting them from their lifetime success. And it may be that some students are better served, and this may sound strange coming from me, but I'm a strong believer. We work closely with the college system. We work closely with technical ed. And I think it's important for us to understand, I kind of think of it as, we need to recruit students who can benefit from a university experience, but we also need to work with our partners to make sure that I would like all of our high school graduates to have a path coming out of high school as to what they can do next in education. And so we try to balance that perspective, I guess, against actual numbers.
Great, and Madam Chair, I'm almost done, I promise you.
One final question.
So my last point, and thanks for the latitude, Madam Chair, and I won't ask a question, but I really would like to have a meaningful conversation, and maybe offline, Madam Chair, we can have a discussion about maybe a potential presentation, but really moving the state university system in a direction where we incentivize mixed-use projects. We know that the PICO pot shrinks, or it is not necessarily a stable pot to get projects done in a specific manner. And so we started talking about CITF funding, we started talking about P3 funding, PICO funding, all those things, trying to come up with ways, especially with many of our state universities being landlocked, to discuss that, how we move forward. And then the final thing is, also would like to get some clarification on non-ENG buildings needing service and maintenance, but utilizing ENG funds. Is there any latitude in that? Because you have non-ENG buildings on campus that they may have a boiler that breaks, they may have an AC unit that breaks, and then subsequently, what are the restrictions, or are there any latitudes for those institutions to use ENG funds to fix those facilities? So we can talk about it offline, and look forward to having that conversation, and I'll stop.
Thank you. Representative Gottlieb, can I ask
for a question? Thank you, Chair. Chancellor, I just have a question. I know it's a brand-new program, but the grandparent waiver. What happens to a student who enters under a grandparent waiver and they are no longer a high-performing student? I recognize it's a new program, so we may not have crossed that bridge yet, but just curious.
Thank you. If you mean if they flunk out?
Well, not flunk out, but sorry, Chair.
Once a student enters a university, I believe they move forward. They continue to move forward as long as they maintain what it takes to become a full-time student, to remain a full-time student. I think the goal would be for those students to complete successfully the same as others do. I could look at that a little bit more and see if there's anything in particular that I'm missing, but I believe that's kind of the general status, is I don't see them treated differently than a resident student of the state of Florida. In this case, they're being treated the same as a resident student.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Caruso, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for the presentation, Chancellor. I have a question with regards to the STEM waiver program. And the different areas that qualify are made very clear. How have we gone about notifying students of the program, and how would they apply for the buy one, get one program?
Well, I guess that's a great, I should have waited and shown you all this later, but I mean, that's one of the issues that we are doing in order to promote the waivers that are available and make sure that we're making students, not just the ones that are enrolling at our universities now, but all of this information is contained within the information that the students work with when they enroll and when they're looking. And my hope is we are hoping we can get to the next level and really understand in these gaps where we have, I guess, what I would call a production issue, which is, are we creating enough degrees, or are we having a retention issue, which is, are students actually looking for jobs in Florida? One of the challenges we've had from a data perspective is being able to parse out students who go. We have some information generally about students who go out of state, but not enough specific information about our students who go out of state. And we've worked very closely in the past year with our board in a task force that is run by Governor Eric Szilagyi, a task force on workforce alignment, where we have been working directly with CEOs also to better understand what their expectations are, particularly in some of these fields. So there's a lot of alignment and several conversations to work our way through this. Is that, and so what I would say is that's the short answer, I gave you a longer answer, is that's a on-university discussion that their guidance counselors, their counselors that help them, and when they go through enrollment from the beginning, students can understand it, as well as the fact that we're publicly advertising it so that, you know, my goal would be for students to ask for it. But we also need to tell them about it.
And Madam Chair, follow up? Madam Chair? Thank you. So students that are currently enrolled in, say, an engineering program and they're in their third year, they've got 60 or plus credit hours, they should seek guidance from their counselor?
I'm sorry, we're automatically applying.
Oh.
So the numbers, as example, when I said what the impact was, this is actually students currently enrolled who will now receive the waiver. And so we are looking at, you know, this is not a next person gets a better deal than you got kind of thing. It's immediate. And so we're actually applying it to the students who are currently enrolled.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
So regarding House Bill 1507, it required a gap analysis of the supply and demand of the healthcare workforce in addition to the part that you outlined. How are those implementation efforts going, and what has your progress been so far?
We're actively involved in those conversations. I will probably misstate the organization, but I also recently saw that University of South Florida is now standing up a new nursing center in the state, or I guess re-standing it up. I think it was an existing organization that's been rehomed. We're working closely with them as well to understand sort of how we evaluate, and we're working with the Department of Health, we're working with the Department of Education. We have been doing gap work. I actually, before I was doing this as a profession, I go back to 2013 when we first began doing a gap analysis within the state university system. I was the business person on the panel at the time, and so we pretty well understand what those methodologies need to be. We also did a separate health assessment, separate gap analysis on health several years ago, but I don't count that as being, it's not current enough to lead us. We need to be current on this issue, and so we're working through that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chancellor. My question is about the free seat waiver. Is there a system-wide application for use at all 12 universities?
No, because not all 12 universities have programs that would be eligible. It would be the short answer to that. So what we did is we found the programs that in my presentation on the chart, you can look to the left, the first column after we name the majors, and actually see the number of universities that offer. So several of these are offered by up to 10 universities.
Thank you. Madam Chair, another question? I have another question. Thank you. Do we have a breakdown of how many of the waiver recipients are active duty, veteran, or non-traditional?
I apologize to you. You asked me about free seat, and I gave you an answer about buy one, get one. I apologize. Would you mind? I apologize. The question is, do we have? Would you mind? I apologize to you. I just totally blanked on your question.
Thank you. I'm looking for a breakdown of how many of the waiver recipients are active duty, veteran, or non-traditional.
I believe we can get that information for you. And in the case of the free seat waiver, I believe that each of the universities, I'll triple check that, but I believe each of the universities is able to extend that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question about the system-wide application for all 12 universities, would you like to change your answer?
No, but what I would say is I believe all 12. I mean, it is an opportunity. We need to look at where their online offerings are, and it would not be across all majors, but where there's an online opportunity.
Thank you, Chancellor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chancellor. HB 233, referencing the intellectual freedom and viewpoint diversity assessment. Has the Board of Governors decided to create the assessment, or has it decided to contract an entity to create it? And if that decision has been made to contract with an entity, has that entity been decided upon?
Madam Chair. What I would describe is we are working with the Political Institute at Florida State University. And when I say working with, I have individuals on my staff who are very good at data and data analysis. They have people that are incredibly talented and do survey work. And so we are trying to understand, you know, what the right questions are and what the right approach is. And also, you know, getting some professional, I'd say they have some professional guidance to us about size and number of questions and the way you ask questions. So I kind of go back. I think I'd say generally we're not contracting out, but we are working closely with them to help develop this. We will then be working with all of the 12 universities in terms of the implementation of it. And we also have to think through how do we analyze the data when it comes back. When we have the survey responses, what's the right approach for understanding how people are responding? Another element of it, I guess I just offer, is maybe I'll say it this way. There are probably not a lot of extroverts on your side of the room. Excuse me, not a lot of introverts on your side of the room. We're also trying to understand, you know, how do students feel differently on our campuses than they feel differently in other aspects of their life so that we can put some context around the responses we get.
Thank you. Madam Chair, one more. So the law requires the results of the assessments by September 1st. When will the actual assessment be conducted?
Thank you. My best way to answer that is it's going to have to be done in spring of 2022 in order for us to have summer to do the assessment and meet our deadline. And so we are working now. We're actually reverse engineering the discussion to say if you were going to have a report due here, when do you have to actually ask the questions? And then how quickly do you have to get the data back? But we will meet the deadline.
Thank you.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you all. I appreciate it.
members, well, that concludes today's agenda. Seeing no other business, Representative Mello moves we rise. Without objection, meeting is adjourned.
We rise.